my colleagues and I on the Federal Open Market Committee decided to keep the target range for the federal funds rate at 1/4 to 1/2%.
I'm verklempt. I'm choked with emotion and hardly able to speak.
The intellectual fear that we can't raise rates because we could be wrong, and the ultimate fear would be to have to reverse policy.
Not only are they running out of reasons, they seem to be almost actively contradicting themselves by saying certain things and then doing other things.
We have to be forward-looking, and I'm not in favor of a whites of their eyes sort of approach. We need to operate based on forecasts.
And the Fed is also stuck making forecasts that haven't even come close to reality.
It's all confusing. I mean, there's hawks and there's doves and perhaps a few chickens. We don't talk about chickens, but there's the bunch of birds there in the pen.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, another good week for the market. Markets, at least as of this Thursday, are still in positive territory. In some of the areas of weakness that we've seen over the past couple of weeks, transports and utilities now having a nice rebound. Over the last 5 days, the utility average is up almost 5%, and we've got transports up close to 2%. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Up on deck in Hour 1, Dave Nikoski from Vermilion Research will be joining us, and he still thinks this market is heading higher with strong leadership in groups like tech, health, and biotech and industrials. He'll be here to tell us about that. And then John Ng will be here from Maison Placements. He'll be talking about gold. He thinks we're going to be taking out those old highs in gold over the next 12 to 15 months. You'll want to hear why he's so bullish. All of that coming up in Hour 1.
And I'm John Loeffler. You know, this week, Federal Chair Janet Yellen said, nope, they're not going to raise interest rates right now, but they might do it in December. Of course, they've been saying that, what, six times this year? And it hasn't actually happened. Investors have had to deal with a lot of the upset of the last two decades, the tech bubble, 9-1-1, Katrina and Rita, oil crises, the financial crisis of 2007-2008, the Arab winter, and all other such related things. We just seem to lurch from one crisis to the next. So exactly what kind of an environment are we in right now? And that's the first part we have to understand is, given this environment, given where the Fed has put us, and this isn't going to change at any time in the near future. And then, you know, we hear about crises, but there's one crisis it doesn't seem anyone's talking about, and neither are the presidential candidates, the pension crisis here in the United States. Whereas in the public sector, we have defined benefit plans. In the private sector, we don't. The real problem is that the defined benefit plans owned by many different levels of government and owed to the people that worked for them are not sustainable. And that crisis is going to hit by the end of this decade. No one's talking about it. So what does that mean when you're planning for retirement? All of that coming up today on The Big Picture. Ryan Poplava is out this week, so we will not have a market report. Jim?
Well, for investors, another good five-day period. Here we are doing this program on Thursday. We've got the Dow up close to a point. We've got transports. Just about everything is looking green this week. Joining me on the program is Dave Nikoski from Vermilion Research. And Dave, everybody was expecting, heading into September and October, we'd have a pretty rough go at it. And we did get a little bit of a correction a couple of Fridays ago. But, you know, considering what happened a year ago when we were in August and we got those big, deep swoons in the market in August and September over fears over China, that hasn't worked out, nor has, let's say, sell and may go away worked out either.
Yeah, I think the market, you know, overall has been, I think across the board, has been really a sign of strength. We're not seeing, you know, 52-week lows in, you know, in terms of price or relative strength in any of the sectors. We can certainly point to some stressful areas of the market, but it's not an overall blanket call in terms of sectors. And I think that that's probably, I think what is much more confusing, it's been much more of a stock-picking market, you know, for the better part of the last 6 months. with the exception of the sectors that have come off the, I think the extreme oversold levels are capitulations, and that has been energy and materials. Aside from that, everything I see in the market is structurally intact yet.
Well, when you see something like we're seeing now, where you're starting to see like the S&P Mid-Cap 400, the Russell 2000 start to pick up, we're also starting to see, let's say, biotech and pharma start to come up, but we're also starting to see gold. What does all that tell you? Is it telling you wide participation? Is there another story here that we're not seeing?
Yeah, I think the average stock is certainly doing much better than the large cap stocks. I think that's historically, when we look at the market, you would expect, you know, small caps to outperform over the long term. Historically, you're going to see, you know, when you start to see, you know, signs of fear, is you would actually see the large caps outperform. Much of the large cap move, you know, can certainly be attributed to, you know, the largest stocks in the market, whether it's an Apple, Amazon types of names out there. But, you know, we're just not seeing that the small caps are giving any way in terms of showing any signs of a potential top at this point.
You know, one area that wasn't doing as well were the transports. As I look at the transports now, it's a good week for the transports. In fact, they're up almost twice as much as the Dow. You know, the Fed met this week. No surprise, I think, to any of our listeners or anybody in the market. It's the sixth time they've done this year that they've delayed. You guys believe they wouldn't hike either. Dave, I know we tend to talk technically here, but now the market is saying December. Do you think they go in December?
I think it's really going to be data dependent. You know, I recall December of last year, I think every strategist on the street, you know, was looking for anywhere from four to, you know, six tightenings throughout the year. You know, what happened to that? Now everyone's backpedaling and trying to determine when the second hike is going to be overall here. And, you know, so far this year, it's not shown up. I think the aspect of when we look for the Fed to tighten, I think you need to take a global view of it. And you still have trouble in a lot of the emerging markets. You still have some trouble in Europe. You had the Brexit that's now behind us, but we still really don't know the outcome of Brexit. We may not know for a year or so. And I think that with so much reflecting in this market, that despite the indexes hitting new highs, we don't have, you know, just absolute wonderful technical patterns in the consumer cyclical. You don't have it in the transports. Yes, you have a rebound in the transports, but you also have some, you know, signs that, you know, if the Fed's not going to tighten and support the dollar, we're going to have a potential for the dollar to top out. You know, I think a breakthrough 93 on the U.S. dollar index would certainly push much of your commodities much higher. Right now, I think we can conclude that the dollar is going to be stuck in a trading range. But again, our view has been that the dollar was going to weaken, you know, in February, and I think we got that right. The dollar so far has not been able to sustain a breakout to new highs. I think that's good for the rest of the world, and I think what we're seeing right now, and many people, many strategists throughout the last decade have been in the camp that, you know, the U.S. cannot decouple from foreign markets, and in essence, we did. I think you've seen the capitulation in the foreign markets in February, and what we're seeing now is we're seeing a recoupling, and I think that's only going to be much stronger for the U.S. and the emerging markets. I do think the emerging markets will do much better, especially if we have a continued decline in the dollar. But I think it's going to raise all boats, and I don't think we're at the point of where we have a blow-off in equities in terms of chart patterns that I see, at least. I think the real bubble is in bonds, and I think the Fed, you know, doesn't want to prick that balloon yet, because when that gets pricked, at some point, you're going to see a significant decline. I think they're letting the markets ease out of bonds slowly, and I think that's probably the right move that they need to do.
So, you know, the dollar has come down a little bit, and it hasn't strengthened. That, to me, Dave, would signal a better situation for exports and manufacturing. Are you seeing any signs sector-wise that manufacturing stocks or cyclical-type stocks are picking up?
Yeah, you've seen it mostly in a lot of the materials names, and you know, they've since had a major pullback until we saw the recent Fed decision. We are seeing, you know, a number of manufacturing-related names actually, you know, continue to build ascending rallies and reactions. We are bullish on the sector. We do have an overweight on it, and I think that that's going to continue as long as we don't see the dollar tick significantly up through the 96 level. I do believe, again, that we're going to see that it's going to be the emerging markets that help the industrials, and I would expect that many analysts are not on top of that. And I think that's probably where the surprise will be, and I think that's why the market, in terms of where we are, in terms of how expensive it is, according to most fundamentalists, I think that's why we're here. It's already discounting that the emerging markets are picking up. That's going to be your incremental demand, and I think it surprises to the upside.
So as you look at this, do you see anything that is starting to emerge as leaders, like leadership categories? Typically, when we see these market runs, there's three or four groups that tend to stand out as leadership groups in a market movement. What are you seeing there?
Well, I think the best breadth that you have in the market in terms of sectors by far is technology. Technology semi-suppliers, software have been dominating this market. And up until today, you know, one of the things that we're seeing that would show, at least from a sentiment standpoint, that investors are willing to increase their risk in the market is we're seeing some of the biotechs break out over the last several weeks. Namely, when you look at an index like the XBI, it's an unweighted index, and it's absolutely wonderful. It has been outperforming the IBB, which is, you know, comprised of the large caps or a market-weighted index. That is just breaking above the 300 level today, and if it can hold, you really truly have a great technical pattern there. Many of you may hear us technicians throw out patterns. You have a cup and a handle there on that particular pattern, and that's a very bullish pattern.
So, Dave, when you see these kind of breakouts that unfold here, you know, one of the things we were talking about, December rate hike, well, that'll be data dependent. The data doesn't look that great right now, and earnings have been in a quarterly decline. So it's obviously fundamental factors such as, let's say, economic growth rates or corporate earnings aren't driving it. It seems to me it's money flows that are driving, and people are just willing to pay more for a dollar's worth of earnings. But when you look at the dividend yield on the S&P, it's still much higher than what you can get in a 10-year treasury bond.
Exactly. And I think what you're seeing is even corporations are not investing in a manner that reflects that they can get a better return than buying their own stock back. And I think that's what's helping, you know, many companies in terms of either increasing their dividends or doing a stock buyback and reducing the number of shares outstanding. But both of them should be positive for the market overall.
Dave, I know you track sectors, you track movements around the globe, ETFs and things like that. Are you seeing any pickup in investor participation in this market, or is this still primarily an institutional-driven market?
We do track the ETFs, and we do it on a global basis, as well as all of the global equity markets, 34 of them to be exact. We are seeing that foreign markets are definitely, you know, doing much better than the U.S. market. You have seen a turn in the EEM versus the U.S. I believe that that's going to continue. And I do believe that most investors are moving towards a passive investing. I think that's been going on for years. And I would expect that to continue. But I also see that a lot more institutions are developing, you know, an ETF strategy. And I think that's a positive sign as well.
You know, I think this is one of the more puzzling things for at least some of us on the fundamental side. You take a look at the fundamentals, whether it's economic growth, corporate earnings, or you take a look at sentiment things like investor behavior and participation. In this market, at least from my perspective, Dave, is driven more institutionally. It's been basically, as you just mentioned, companies buying back their stock. It's been central banks even getting into the stock market. So it's been more institutionally driven, and people don't realize you get central banks or corporations buying back stock, you're talking about hundreds, if not trillions of dollars that have gone into this market from the institutional level.
Exactly. And again, it comes down to, you know, what's your ROI if you're a company and you're looking at the fixed income market and you're realizing $14 trillion had been recently invested into zero or negative income. They're not getting any return for having that cash, and they can do two things with it: pay out a higher dividend or buy back their stock. And I think that, you know, majority of them are seeing that, hey, this is a better investment for where we should put our funds. Interesting to note that when you look back in history, and look at other time periods in which we hit record low yields, and it was post World War II, late in the 40s, early 50s. You know, interest rates did move up from 50 all the way up to going to the bull market that ended in, you know, 1969, 1972, and the markets went north even in the face of higher interest rates. I can't see that far ahead in terms of what's going to cause the growth. Obviously, post World War II, you had a lot of rebuilding, and you just had the rise of the American family. The automobile industry took off, so you had a lot of backbone to push the markets higher. I don't know what that is at this point, but, you know, it's interesting to note that, hey, there was another time we had low interest rates like this, and they went up, and the markets actually went up with it.
You know, it's rather interesting when you see this kind of development in markets change. Every bull market's a little bit different. If you look at this scenario going forward, where everything is looking like we're seeing widespread participation in the various sectors of the market, in pickups in certain areas that, for example, emerging markets, if there was anything that would cast a cloud on your scenario or where you see things going, what would that be?
It would be interest rates. And when I mean interest rates, I don't think it's a matter of what the Fed chooses to do with interest rates. I think it's what investors are going to do with interest rates. And let me give you an example. You start that tipping point in fixed income products around the world that are getting negative or zero interest rates, that can tilt very quickly. And the question is how fast does it tilt to the point at which you take a lot of countries that have a negative yield and move it to a positive yield? Those investors are going to look at their statements quarterly, and they're going to see that, hey, I'm actually losing money. I made money for 5-10 years, and now this is going against me. I need to reduce my positions. That is where I think the biggest risk to this overall global market, I think, would falter, depending on how fast they rose.
Yeah, because one of the things that we're starting to see in the spread markets, Dave, is the spread difference between sovereign debt, let's say in Japan or Europe and the U.S., is wider. But when you start taking in the cost of currency hedges, a lot of that disadvantage has gone away, and that in itself could drive rates up.
Absolutely.
So given your perspective right now, if you had to deploy money to work, what would be your favorite sectors that you think have offer the best return possibilities?
Well, we're overweight in energy, materials, manufacturing, and technology. We recently raised financials to an overweight. We had been a market weight in that since July. I do believe that as interest rates go up and we see the yield curve expand a little bit, I think that's going to be helpful for the financials. I think, again, the biggest risk, I think, to the market is the fixed income markets and how fast rates go up. And again, I don't think that's going to be something that's done by the Fed. I think it's going to be investors that change the tone to the fixed income market.
And that, I think, Dave, would be a surprise to the marketplace, because we spend so much time in this financial industry. I mean, what do we talk about every single month? Are they or are they not going to raise interest rates? And I think if rates started going up as a result of investors demanding higher rate of returns, that would be certainly something the market is not expecting. Well, Dave, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, how could they do so, please?
They can call us at 952-922-7500, or they can go to Vermilion Cap. There's one L in Vermilion, vermilioncap.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at FinancialSense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Well, some important deadlines are coming up for Medicare. Joining me as my special guest is David Sein. He had a distinguished career as regional administrator out of San Francisco for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. Currently, he's senior vice president of the Gorman Health Group. And David, let's talk about this enrollment period that's coming up here. I believe it's October 15th to December 7th. Let's talk about the implications of that, who needs to be aware of it, and also about what happens when you turn 65.
Right. And people often conflate the issues of enrolling for the Medicare program initially with this annual period that is associated with making changes in your coverage. And so with respect to the former, which is important, people become eligible for Medicare typically when they're 65 or when they've been on Social Security disability for 48 months. And in both of those cases, if you're going along and you're paying into Social Security, they're going to notify you. But then there are people that choose not to take Medicare at 65, perhaps because they're working and they have health insurance. Down the road, when those individuals decide that they want to drop or they lose that other coverage and they want Medicare, they have to tell the Social Security Administration that they want to do that because there's no way that the government would know. And you don't want to end up with a break in coverage, particularly if you're over 65. I'm past 60 myself. And, you know, our health insurance is very important to us as we get further along in life, because we're going to get a lot further along if we can take care of what our problems are. The other issue at hand, of course, coming in October, is this ability to make changes in the kinds of Medicare coverage that you have.
Well, after a brief correction, gold continues to advance forward, being one of the top performing investment classes this year. Will it continue and how far will it go? Joining me on the program is John Eng from Maison Placements. John, let's go back to the beginning of the year where we got a low of 1252 in December of last year, and then we got a high of 1384 on gold in July, and then we pull back somewhat, which is not unusual. We usually see weakness during the summer, but as we head into the fall, what is your assessment in terms of gold's potential? Typically, it's a strong season for gold buying. You have got Christmas coming up. You've got the Indian wedding season. What's your take here in terms of gold's possibilities?
Well, that's a good question. For the first part of this year, as we know, gold has been powered by negative interest rates. Now, what's of interest in the last few days is gold's having its Charlie Brown moment, I call it. We see now that interest rates are not going to go up in the United States. Yellen again, while flagging earlier that they were looking at the possibilities, they pulled the football away, the opportunity away, and now it looks like any price increase would happen after the election. And so traders are then must look at the fundamentals, and as you mentioned, there are seasonal factors, but there's also the factor of China's purchases. They bought 10 tons last month. They now hold something like 1,833 tons of gold. That's an increase of something like 200% over 2003 when they held about 600 tons. China has been sort of the big gorilla, and they continue to buy mainly because of their diversification and reluctance to rely on the U.S. dollar. Russia has also joined them, and so what we see is some good central banking purchases. The other factor at work is the ongoing, now that we're focusing, is the European problems and the European banking system. Here we have the EU not only had a blow from Brexit, but also now there's a referendum in October and in Italy, and that's over the government and possibly their failing banking system. And the Italian banks are under pressure, including the oldest bank in the world, Monte dei Paschi. So we have Deutsche Bank of concerns, and so that's a sort of festering away. And then the big sort of uncertainty, of course, is your election. And sadly, and some people say that too bad there must be a winner. But really is the election, just as we saw, where the street expectations were that Britain was not going to opt for Brexit. Now I think the markets are more or less still believing that Hillary Clinton will win. If there is in the next few weeks a turn on that, then I think that the financial markets will be very, very upset, and you could see as much as a $100 move in the price of bullion. So what we have is a blow through the resistance that we are encountering right now at 1340. The next line of resistance is 1422, but I expect the big move for gold is coming after we had the backing and filling, so to speak.
And John, let's talk about, we're having this interview on a Thursday. Wednesday, the Fed delayed raising interest rates for the sixth time this year. Of course, they're implying they'll go in December. Who knows? I see a weakening U.S. economy, so it'd be really strange that they would raise rates when we're seeing a deceleration of U.S. economic growth. But let's talk about central banks, because we have seen the balance sheet of the Fed expand. We've seen the ECB expand, the Bank of Japan. And John, yet we're seeing anemic economic growth. So what comes next? Some suggest that perhaps we'll see it in Europe, Japan, and eventually here, is helicopter drops, where monetary policy is beginning to lose its effectiveness. And so what happens next is governments begin to expand fiscal spending, expanding their deficits, and central banks will just simply come in and monetize the debt.
Well, that's a very good point, because I think the first world is suffering from the second world problems. I mean, helicopter money is no different from what's happening today in Venezuela or Nigeria, where they have been just printing money without abandon, and now they have hyperinflation. The reality is we only, if we talk about helicopter money, which Mr. Bernanke had brought up, we only have to know the consequences. So you're right that the central banks have run out of ammunition, and thus the talk of helicopter money. Unfortunately, it's my belief that we have cheapened money so much that, and we have brought interest rates so much lower that it's unsustainable. And before we get to that helicopter money, there's the basic reality is that you in the United States have to finance your deficits. And the dollar has, I can recall just around Jackson Hole, the dollar was around 97. The dollar today is closer to 95, the trade weighted dollar. And my expectation, if we get a surprise in November or as the election comes closer, the U.S. dollar will be under further pressure, raising question marks about the big deficits, about the spending that's still been going on. And after all, you still rely on outsiders such as the Russians and such as the Japanese, such as the Chinese, and that will mean that the market could dictate higher rates or hint of higher rates, and that would be devastating for the dollar. So there's a convergence of events this fall that could be very bad for the financial markets.
And John, as we talk about this, one of the things that we've seen, there are wide spreads between, let's say, European debt, Japanese debt. But as I take a look at the cost of hedging currencies, so let's say there's a wide spread between Japanese debt and U.S. debt. But when you start to add in the cost of hedging the currency, it takes away the advantage of that spread. So it is possible, even though rates are higher in the U.S., that you could start to see rates rising for these very reasons.
Well, that's right. And the other factor at work, and a lot of investors have said to me, well, geez, look at the booming stock market. How could that happen? And when you look at what the central banks are doing, in fact, overseas, you have the Swiss National Bank buying $1 billion worth of ETFs. You have the Japanese bank sopping up their financial markets. This is, at one time, they were only supposed to buy sovereign debt, and now they're buying ETFs, and some of the bankers are creating product for the central banks to buy under their so-called quantitative easing programs. And what this does, not only do we have low interest rates, which raises the risk profile, but there's an illusion of prosperity and not the problems. And I believe, again, that is also unsustainable and exposes the balance sheets of these central banks to potentially big losses when we do get the market dictates higher rates.
John, let's talk about the fundamentals of gold itself. We talked about negative interest rates, central bank policies, which are some drivers. You've got demand, and a good example is what happened as a result of these policies in Japan when they went to negative interest rates. The Japanese consumer began to put their cash in mattresses. They began to buy safes. They began to buy gold. What is the possibility of meeting that extra demand without driving up the price? In other words, what's the state of the gold industry after what has been a very devastating bear market in gold prices, where, you know, you often read where a lot of the major miners, including Barrick and others, are shutting down some of their mines or putting them on hold, especially new projects. So let's talk about the capability of the industry meeting demand.
That's a very good question. Again, what we have is peak gold. This year, less gold will come to the market. Of interest is that during the mini bear market for the gold miners, they learned to make a profit out of the ounces they produce instead of losses. At one time, as we know, the mining industry, just the quest for growth, they really didn't care about profitability. Barrick has led the way in pruning costs and selling off higher cost gold mines or non-core assets, and that's emulated now by Goldcorp, which has had its problems. So what we see is that last year, of the dozen-odd major gold mines, only two of those gold mines increased reserves. So what I'm saying is that not only are we seeing less production from the gold miners, but they are depleting the reserves in the ground. Now, one would think that they would explore, but exploration costs big money, and we've had the low-hanging fruit already plucked. In fact, there is a shortage of deposits. The other factor at work is that even if you do find a magnificent discovery, it could take you anywhere from 6 to 8 years to finance, to bring that property into production. So there's actually a lack of gold mines coming to the market. We also have at work the Chinese, who are the world's largest producers of gold in the world. Their gold mines are very shallow, and in fact, they run out of reserves by 2020. So there's a dilemma is that in a few years, their mines run out of reserves, and they are also the biggest consumer of gold, and so they continue to be a big importer. So they are a factor in the gold markets. So when I talk to the Barricks of the world and I say, okay, you're selling some of your gold mines, where are you to get the future production? And so they're using technology. Barrick has just done a deal with Cisco, and that's almost unheard of in a very staid industry like the mining industry, but they're looking for efficiencies. I also see more M&A because some of these bigger companies have the financial heft to bring on some of these deposits. The other factor at work is that mine grade has been cut in half. And so what that means, Jim, is that its costs keep on increasing. So the fact is we're not finding enough gold mines, and the gold mines that we are finding are fairly low grade. So there's going to be a premium for any astute discoverer who finds a high-grade deposit in a geographic area that can bring on that mine into production and finance. And so my expectation is that we've had peak gold, and that bodes well for, of course, the gold price on a longer-term basis.
So, John, as we look at this, you know, and I see a similar pattern that we've seen in the oil industry. Just like the drop in gold, we've seen a drop in oil prices. We've seen companies delay projects. We've seen them cut back on CapEx. We've seen workers get laid off in the industry. And as you know, mining or, let's say, drilling for oil is not an industry where you flip a switch on and production ramps up. They take long, as you mentioned, 8 to 10 years to bring a mine or an oil field into production. So as these companies sell oil, sell their gold or silver, in terms of replacing, since that takes long, Do you see a point in time where companies basically replace their reserves by going shopping on Wall Street? In other words, if somebody like a junior or a smaller company has already done the work, brought a mine to production or close to feasibility, why not just buy them and ramp up the process?
That's a very good point. It's cheaper to, even today with the move in gold, it's cheaper to buy ounces on Wall Street than it is to go out and explore. And I say that because I took the top dozen gold miners and I took their reserves and I also looked at their market cap. And it's astonishing that the market cap per reserves in the ground, in situ reserves, are close to around $300 an ounce. That's very, very low given the fact that the price of gold today. So my sense is that there are, while there was a lot of takeover talk a few years ago when gold was running, my expectation is that the reluctance to pay the goodwill, to pay the premium, gold miners will have no choice but to buy some of these smaller gold miners out there. And so I see a lot of infill acquisitions, and there are some single mines out there, and my expectation is that there's a consolidation in order.
Yeah, John, I want to turn to another precious metal, silver, which has also been doing well this year. As our listeners may not know, a good majority of silver, 75 to 80% of it, comes as a byproduct of mining, either gold mining or copper mining or other types of mining. What's the condition of the silver industry, and what's your view on silver?
Well, I'm bullish on silver. It's often called poor man's gold, and you're quite right that silver is a byproduct of mining. Sadly, the sort of the flatness of the commodity price means that there is less silver coming to the market. There's a great many silver players in that have been looking for those ounces exploration-wise, but they too, like the gold mining business, have not been able to bring on the big deposits. Barrick, for example, has potentially the biggest silver mine in the world in Pascua Lama, but they need another $4 billion to bring that on stream. So investors focus on the Pan Americans and some of the Mexican silver producers. There's one little one like Exelon up here that will double its production. It's got the highest grade in Mexico, and grade is very important because the cost of bringing on that silver for many producers I've seen is in excess of $14, $15 an ounce, and with a cost of with a price of $20 an ounce, it's a pretty skinny margin. So the dilemma is for the silver companies is to make money, and while there's a lot of them looking for silver, there's only a handful that can make good money at these prices.
John, what happened to a lot of the silver producers in the industry itself? Because I know prior to the drop in the price of silver in 2011 when it peaked, you had a lot of silver producers that came online. They were starting, you know, some of them were small, maybe 2-3 million ounces, some of them trying to get bigger, but they needed higher silver prices. What happened to these companies when you got silver down into, let's say, the $14 level?
Well, a great many closed their doors or, in fact, were bought up by Pan American. Some of them got involved in silver in streaming deals, which was really a last gasp way for some of the silver producers to finance their production. And when they could not satisfy their obligations, they were bought over or were made to consolidate. And so really the silver players, pure silver players, there's just a shortage of areas where they can look for silver. So unlike gold, which had a lot of gold companies looking in countries like Indonesia and some frontier areas, the silver players, there's Latin America, Mexico, parts of Canada, parts of the United States, there's really not a lot, which is why we look to recycling or byproducts. So silver companies look quite attractive given the expectations is while it's trading around $20, if gold does $2,200 an ounce in the next 18 months, as I expect, I would not be surprised to see a $25, $26 silver price, which is very profitable for some of the existing producers today.
John, given where you expect that precious metals may head over the next year and the drivers behind it, would you be buying bullion here? In other words, if you were an investor and you wanted to get your, let's say, dip into the market, would you begin with bullion?
There's no question in my mind that I would begin with bullion. Right now, there is a more paper gold that's out there, just like paper oil, paper zinc, and in fact, there's too much. On COMEX today, for example, which is one of the biggest bullion markets, it's a paper market. Whereas you look at the equivalent size market in Shanghai gold market, on the Shanghai gold market, the Chinese have withdrawn from that market something in the order of 2,500 tons of gold in the past 12 months. In comparison, on COMEX, there's something like 50 tons. My expectation is that the Chinese and others are buying physical gold instead of, as in the past, paper gold. And in fact, the ETFs originally sopped up a lot of the physical gold market, finding that there's not enough physical gold around. They started buying the paper gold. And my expectation is that there is a shortage of this physical gold. After all, we talked about less gold coming to the market from the gold miners. And so my thinking is that there will eventually be a premium for physical gold.
So, and then when it comes to stocks, you know, one of the things about mining is you have mining risk. A mine can be shut down or you can have a mine accident. There's all kinds of problems. You could have political issues. Would an investor be better off in something like an ETF or a mutual fund rather than trying to pick those stocks themselves?
Well, it's different strokes for different folks, and it all depends on the risk profile. My sense is that the gold miners that have survived this last cycle are the future 10 baggers, so to speak. Gold mines, gold shares, provide leverage to the gold price. It's no coincidence that the multiplier effect is about 4 times. So we have seen the big kahunas like a Barrick go up 4 times more than 4 times of the bullion price. So these are the producers. The near developers have also, those are who have already discovered their gold mines, are waiting to finance and hoping to finance. They will likely be the next big movers other than the producers, which we've seen. They're in the next wave, so to speak. And my sense is they can bring on production in the next 2-3 years. It's the exploration stocks, which are always tempting because they're big reward but big risk. They have a lot of companies continue to explore, but and some have had good news, but their stocks have been flat on their backs. That tells me that the market is not yet ready for the exploration. But once you get gold over to the $1,400 area, I think that the explorers will pick up. The mutual funds, they've been losing market share to the ETFs. It's no question the ETFs are popular because it costs less to invest in. You don't have to pay them as big of a management fee. They've been very, very attractive. I think it, as I said, that it all depends on the risk profile of the individual investor.
All right. Well, listen, John, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, I know you write a monthly newsletter. How could they do so?
Just contact our website, Maison Placement Canada.
Coming up next on The Big Picture, you know, Fed Chair Janet Yellen said, ta-da-da, they're not raising interest rates right now. I mean, there's always speculation about that, but they have refused to raise interest rates 6 times this year, although she intimated we may do that in December. And you know, investors are having to deal with just an awful lot of stuff. We've had a whole series of crises for the last 16 years. We seem to lurch from one crisis into the next crisis. So what should we make about it? The markets and the economy of the world seem to be divorced from the fundamentals of markets and operating on low liquidity and low interest rates. So Jim and I will discuss that intensely coming up next in The Big Picture. We do have a crisis in the United States, one the politicians aren't discussing. That is the pension crisis, and it's going to come home to roost within the next 4 years by 2020, in which the public sector will not be able to provide the pensions that it's promised promising to the people who think they are earning them by working for various governmental agencies. All of that coming up next on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.